Senate Judiciary Committee, Friday, February 16th, 2007, at 9:30 a.m., location, University of Oregon School of Law, Room 175.
Welcome, everyone. Call to order the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Ginny Burdick. I'm chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I just want to let you all know how pleased we are to be here in Eugene. As you may have read in the paper, we are considering bills today dealing with the smoking issue, and I thought it was very appropriate to have it in a community, both pro and con, have it in a community that has actually been living with this law for some time. Oftentimes in the legislature, we pass laws with very good intent, but sometimes you really don't know how they're going to work on the ground until they actually go into effect. And Eugene has had the kind of setup down here with banning smoking in all kinds of locations, including bars, that these bills would call for. So I thought both proponents and opponents could speak knowledgeably about that. I want to just thank a couple people who helped. It's always quite a project getting out on the road for these meetings, but I feel it's very important to do that so that we can take the work of the people to the people in areas other than Salem. And I wanted to thank Assistant Dean Merv Loya of the Law School and Jill Forcier, who just did wonderful work on logistics. She works up there and as an assistant. And my sister, Mary Wood, who doesn't want any credit. She told me she didn't do a thing, but that's a lie. She teaches law here at the University of Oregon. I'm very proud of her. And it's especially pleasing to bring the Judiciary Committee to the law school, because that's kind of what we're about. So I'm going to start off by having the committee introduce themselves. I'll start. I represent a district that includes Southwest Portland, Tigard, and King City. And I've been a member of the Judiciary Committee for almost my entire legislative career. My first session was 1997. I love the issues we deal with in this committee. I'm very fond of lawyers, so it's a good fit for me. So I'll start down. We have actually two natives of this area on this committee, and I'll start with one of them, Senator Pruzanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to thank everyone for allowing us to be here, and I will go ahead and take credit since I get to speak before Senator Walker gets to speak. She gets to clean up on this. First, welcome to the district. This is actually Bill Morsett's district that we're currently in. It's kind of unique the way the lines are drawn for redistricting. 15th and Agate, which is just outside, is the break line. And so the university proper, as well as Agate Hall, which is just to the south of us, are actually in Bill's district. Everything else in the area of the University of Oregon is in my district. Not to be confused with Senator Walker's residents that live over on the Otson side of everything. But very thankful that we could have the meeting here. I think it's wonderful that we are actually utilizing the law school to give an opportunity for, hopefully, for young attorneys who might be looking at public service as an opportunity of how they can actually use their skill sets. And I also have been on judiciary with my background as a prosecutor since my first session, which was 1995, and I think that put me in judiciary in the House four terms, and then been in the Senate. This is my second term as to serving on the judiciary. So thank you for letting us be here, and we really appreciate you being part of the process.
Roger. Senator Beyer?
I'm Roger Beyer. My district is District 9, which includes parts of Linn, Clackamas, and Marion counties, the east side of each of those counties. So it runs from the Willamette River on the north at Wilsonville down to the Lane County line, out by Sweet Home, between here and Sweet Home.
Oh, yes. Welcome. Yeah, well, you are not in my district, but a lot of the folks who go to this institution are in my district. Senator Pruzanski and I argue about that a lot. I do. My residence is across the river, but I represent people on this side of the river as well. I'm happy to be here. I'm a court reporter by trade for 23 years. Did that instead of going to law school. it's been nice, but I would have liked to have been a lawyer, but it is nice making the law that you have to interpret out here. So I do enjoy that aspect of it, and welcome to our community, and I see our mayor is here today, so we're going to have an opportunity to hear from our mayor, and thank you very much.
I'm Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is southern Douglas County, parts of Jackson and Josephine, all of Curry County, and two-thirds of Coos. So slightly bigger geographic district than Senator Walker's, obviously. So this is my first time on a judiciary committee. I've been in the legislature since 97. This is my first term in the Senate. I spent most of my time dealing with health care and now education, and happened to make an offhand comment before session started to the Senate President when we were talking about committee assignments that I said, at some point in my political career, I think I'd like to serve on judiciary. And Peter Courtney, who's Senate President, loves judiciary committees. And we had been talking for about a half hour at that point in time, and then he basically gave me about a 20-minute talk on how wonderful judiciary was and all the people he had served with, and I left the meeting knowing I was going to be here. So, and very pleased to be serving on this committee. Being in the legislature is an incredible education, and being on judiciary is a completely separate education, and I think I will probably be able to sit for the bar when we're done. So.
It's a poor man's way of going to law school, is what it is. Thank you. And, of course, we're the elected people that just introduced ourselves, but we wouldn't amount to much if it weren't for our staff. And our staff today is Darian Stanford, who actually came to us from the Multnomah County DA's office and is a lawyer and prosecutor, former prosecutor, current prosecutor. And we also have Bill Taylor from our staff. Raise your hand, Bill, from our judiciary staff. And my personal staff, and Jennifer Black and Sarah Campbell are helping out today. And then my personal staff in my office, I'm very fortunate to have a member of the bar on my staff, Natasha Dolezal. And raise your hand, Natasha. And Jordan Rash. And back there is Rob Schwartz, who's one of the wonderful interns that Assistant Dean Loya sent us this time. He's really done a very good job of sending great law students to help us out during sessions, for several sessions now. So with that, the process today, we have three bills in front of us all on the same subject. The bill that we will be working with primarily and focusing on as a committee is Senate Bill 571. The other two bills have individual sponsors, including Senator Morissette, who we expect to have in later today to speak. And his bill and Senator Abel Gordley's bills deal with some of the subject matter of Senate Bill 571. Both Senator Gordley and Senator Morissette are also sponsors of Senate Bill 571. So that's the more comprehensive bill. For those of you who signed up for one of the other bills, feel free to comment on any of the three bills, and same with those who signed up for 571. But as we move forward on this issue, we will be focusing on Senate Bill 571. So I just wanted to make that clear. And what we're going to do today is we're going to start out with two panels. We're going to have a panel of proponents of Senate Bill 571, and they are going to have a half hour to present the arguments in favor of this bill. And then the opponents of this bill will have also a half hour. When we have questions at the end of the panel discussions, that will not count against their time. So we'll start that out, and then we will move into public testimony. And what we will do is we will alternate between proponents and opponents until we run out of one side or the other, and then we'll just take people as they come. So with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 571, Senate Bill 419, and Senate Bill 354. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 571, I'll talk about first. It, of course, relates to smoking. Subject to a number of exceptions, Oregon presently restricts the ability to smoke in public places and places of employment. Each of these terms is defined by reference to enclosed areas with certain characteristics. Senate Bill 571 expands Oregon's prohibition in smoking in several ways. First, it makes three key definitional changes. An enclosed area now can be three-sided rather than needing to be enclosed on all sides, and it can involve permanent or temporary walls as opposed to solid walls. The term place of employment would now also include work vehicles, meeting rooms, elevators, stairways, and certain healthcare facilities. And the term public place would now include any enclosed area open to the public. Present law includes a number of exceptions. Those would be eliminated. Second, Senate Bill 571 prohibits smoking within 25 feet of the entrance, exit, open window, or ventilation intake of any public place or any place of employment. Third, Senate Bill 571 eliminates many existing exceptions to the rule that an employer needs to provide a smoke-free workplace. Under existing law, these exceptions include, but aren't limited to, tobacco stores, bars, restaurants, bingo halls, bowling alleys, and lounges. Senate Bill 571 eliminates all existing exceptions, and it replaces these with two new exceptions. First, up to 25% of hotel rooms may be designated as smoking. And then second, smoking of non-commercial tobacco products may be for ceremonial purposes under the Federal American Indian Religious Freedom Act. Fourth, Senate Bill 571 diverts civil fines collected by the Oregon Department of Human Resources for noncompliance from the general fund to the tobacco use reduction account. Fifth, Senate Bill 571 enhances a potential penalty against a noncompliant employer from a maximum of $50 a day to a maximum of $500 a day, and from a maximum of $1,000 in a 30-day period to $2,000 in a 30-day period. And the final thing then that Senate Bill 571 does is it repeals ORS 433.863, which is existing law that limits a local government's ability to prohibit smoking, and it eliminates ORS 433.865, which allows Department of Human Services to waive smoking prohibitions in certain circumstances. That's Senate Bill 571. Senate Bill 354 is very similar to Senate Bill 571. Just a couple of noteworthy differences are rather than 25 feet, it uses 10 feet as the operative distance that it prohibits smoking in certain areas, and there's a different fine amount. Senate Bill 419 also then restricts smoking, but it does so in a much narrower fashion. It essentially eliminates the exceptions for an employer's duty to provide a smoke-free workplace for bars, taverns, and restaurants.
Thank you, Council. We will start out with our first panel, which includes your mayor here in Eugene, Mayor Kitty Percy, Courtney Dresser from the American Cancer Society, Dr. Don Austin from the Oregon Public Health Association, and Dr. Katrina Hedberg from the Department of Human Resources, and Wendy Watson, who is a bartender, and Dr. Martin Jones, who's a family physician here in Eugene. Okay. And if you will all, as the mayor definitely knows, and some of you, most of you know, you need to start out by identifying your name for the record. And while you're getting seated, I'll remind people in the audience and anyone who's listening to this that this will be available. This hearing will be available on the internet by audio in a delayed way. We're not able to broadcast live from here as we do from the Capitol, but it'll be available in a day or two. So welcome you all to the committee. It's your show, so go ahead.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Dresser, and I'm with the American Cancer Society. I am speaking on behalf today of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, which includes the Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, and the American Lung Association of Oregon. These organizations and their members statewide want to express the support for Senate Bill 571. Secondhand smoke kills, period, end of story. I wish I could just stop there, but I have some more things to say. It kills 800 people each year in Oregon alone. It ends life in many ways, including lung cancer, emphysema, heart attacks, and sudden infant death syndrome. This legislation is not an anti-smoker bill. This is not an anti-business bill. This legislation is about the health of workers, the profitability of business, and the public health. As the U.S. Surgeon General concluded when issuing a groundbreaking report in June 2006, the debate is over, the science is clear, and secondhand smoke is not just an annoyance, but a serious health hazard that causes death and disease in children and adults. Every day in Oregon, 35,000 people go to work in an environment that is slowly killing them. We hear often that people who can just get another job. In response to that, I would ask that the committee members remember that this is a state law. Getting another job in Portland or Salem or Eugene might be okay, but it's not so easy to get another similar paying job in Joseph or Enterprise or North Bend. You will hear from more from our panel about how there is no safe amount of exposure when it comes to secondhand smoke, and no one should have to go to work every day in a smoke-filled environment. Opponents of this legislation will talk about the decline in business if this bill is to pass. However, there is no clear evidence of that. In fact, there are 16 other states that have passed this law, and they still have a restaurant association, they still have bars, and people still go out and enjoy themselves at those places. In fact, the numerous peer-reviewed studies have shown that after they go smoke-free, many businesses either see their business impact go up in the sense that they have more sales receipts and an increase in employment retention. This is publicly supported. In our neighboring state of Washington, voters overwhelmingly passed a comprehensive law with 63% of voters supporting smoke-free Washington. In fact, the measure passed in all 39 of Washington's counties, rural and urban. In Oregon, our latest poll numbers show that 67% agree with smoke-free places of employment. The public is educated. They understand that secondhand smoke is dangerous to a person's health. The time to act is now on this legislation. Our state was once known as a national leader on tobacco control. Today, we are viewed as falling behind. Every surrounding state around Oregon has a stronger smoke-free law than our state. We are failing to protect people from something that we all know to be incredibly dangerous. And we encourage you to support the passage of Senate Bill 571.
Thank you. Mayor
Percy. Thank you, Chair Burdick and the committee. It's a pleasure to have you in Eugene. I get to welcome you to Eugene as a mayor. And I guess I can say your district's my district. Anyway, it's fun to have you in the community, and I have to say I had to drive to Salem yesterday and was glad to not have to do it today. So thank you for coming here. On behalf, and I also want to say that I know that you, all of you, share a really deep interest in the health and well-being of the people in this community as well as people across the state, or we wouldn't even be having this discussion. So I appreciate it. On behalf of Eugene, I urge passage of legislation that will protect Oregonians from secondhand smoke in all public places, including places of employment. Senate Bills 354, 571, and House Bill 2571 offer better protection for our state citizens. These bills are in front of you because every Oregonian deserves to live, work, and patronize in smoke-free environments. Study after study and the work of healthcare experts have proven to us that smoking and secondhand smoke cause cancer and other chronic diseases such as heart disease, asthma, and bronchitis. No one should have to choose between a job and the dangers of tobacco smoke. It's not only a cruel choice to force on Oregon citizens, it's a costly one. That means higher medical costs for everyone. So it's an economic decision as well as a healthcare decision. Eugene City Council in 2000 adopted an ordinance regulating tobacco smoking and sales. This followed extensive public testimony and debate. We heard from business owners and others who told us that the ordinance interfered with commerce and with freedom of their employees and patrons to choose where they wanted to be. But we also heard compelling stories from food and beverage servers, medical professionals, and our neighbors about the real effects of secondhand smoke. In the end, as elected officials, we agreed it was our responsibility to provide protection to all of our community members. Eugene banned smoking inside bars, restaurants, banks, offices, and other facilities. Our community also restricts smoking within 10 feet of most building entrances and within 25 feet of entrances, windows, and openings to buildings owned by the public. We adopted this 25-foot buffer as a green building measure to further improve indoor air quality in the public's assets. Oregon's existing law does not go far enough for all Oregonians. We urge you to take the next steps by extending the smoking prohibition to all public places and places of employment in this great state. You can do two things: provide a fair baseline for businesses in all of our communities, and two, demonstrate that Oregonians in every town and city, not just here, deserve a healthy place to live, work, and visit. In addition to expanding the smoking ban, we also ask you to clearly and tightly define an enclosed area. On a very limited basis in Eugene, smoking is allowed in covered outdoor smoking areas at bars and restaurants. When these areas are open to the outside air on at least three sides, based on our experience, we encourage you to tightly define the definition of enclosed area. Permitting smoking in rooms and spaces with two walls, in our experience, will not allow enough free flow of air to be safe and comfortable for employees and patrons. As I heard you say earlier, I think in the bill, we also have discovered over time that people can be very innovative about putting up temporary walls in so-called open spaces, and that those prohibit the flow of air in the rooms and really go against what the ban intends to do. So I think that that's in the bill, and it really deserves attention. We also believe that Section 8 of Senate Bill 354-571 and House Bill 2571, which repeals ORS 433.863 and 433.865, the provision in the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act that preempts the ability of local government to adopt smoking prohibitions, is also an important step. Communities should retain authority to exercise local control over local responsibilities. Thank you for your time and consideration. We greatly appreciate your attention to this vital issue of health and justice.
Thank you very much. Just for a time check, you have about 20 minutes left. That's about 5 minutes per person left. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I work for Oregon Public Health Division. I'm here on behalf of Mel Cohn, the state epidemiologist, who's out of town. Actually, he's on the other side of the country. So it's my pleasure to be here today. I was asked to speak a little bit about the Surgeon General's report, and I think I was told I had more like 10 minutes, but I'll try to keep my comments brief. As you can see, it's a very thick volume. Oregon's made a lot of progress around secondhand smoke and protecting workers, and clearly Eugene is in one of the forefronts of that, but there are a lot of people around the state who are not as lucky, and the goal of the Public Health Division is to protect the health of all Oregonians, and so we would support passage of legislation that would help restrict secondhand smoke exposure. I wanted to echo again that quote from the Surgeon General. The debate is over, and the science is clear. Secondhand smoke is dangerous to people's health. This document is actually the second Surgeon General's report dealing with secondhand smoke exposure. The first came out more than 20 years ago in 1986. And outlined some of the health hazards related to it. Since that time, there have been literally thousands of different studies done between animal models and human people exposed and not exposed, workplace, home, etc. So there is an enormous amount of evidence now. So there really is no debate about the science. What I'm going to focus on, this report deals a lot also with secondhand smoke exposure in the home and to children, but I'm going to focus my comments on the workplace and workplace exposure to secondhand smoke. And I'll be covering three areas covered in the Surgeon General's report, what secondhand smoke is and what the known dangerous health effects are, as well as then addressing some comments about specific to secondhand smoke in the workplace. So what is secondhand smoke? I think we talk about it a lot, and we sort of assume we know what it is, but it's composed of two things. It's sidestream smoke that comes off the end of a cigarette when the smoker is smoking, so it's, you know, the entrails that you see in the air. And it's also the smoke that is exhaled by the person smoking. Now, it's estimated that at least 250 toxic or cancer-causing chemicals are present in secondhand smoke. It contains many of the same chemicals that are inhaled by smokers, but actually sidestream smoke is at a lower temperature than that that's directly inhaled, and because it's produced under different conditions, in fact may have higher concentrations of some of the very harmful chemicals. It's been designated as a known human carcinogen, that is a cancer-causing agent, by a lot of different agencies, the Environmental Protection Agency, National Toxicologic Program, International Agency for Research on Cancer, and the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. So there really is no debate about it causing cancer. And, of course, the when workers in the workplace or others are exposed to secondhand smoke, they don't have a choice. They are inhaling many of these toxic chemicals that are not part of their choice. Now, I have a couple of handouts or visual aids. This is your own special copy of the executive summary. If anybody would like the full report, I'm happy to give you mine. It's probably good bedside reading for those who are insomniacs. And then just a little bit of a diagram, and then these models, too, that you can just pass down. And I'll be talking about each of these. So what are the dangerous health effects of secondhand smoke? Secondhand smoke causes disease, premature death in children and adults who don't smoke. And as was mentioned previously, around 800 people in Oregon die each year from secondhand smoke. So, lung cancer. We all know that smoke causes lung cancer. Non-smokers who are exposed to secondhand smoke in either the home or in the workplace are at 20 to 30% increased risk of dying from lung cancer than those who are not exposed to secondhand smoke. It causes heart disease. Breathing secondhand smoke for even a short time can cause immediate effects on the cardiovascular system and interferes with the functioning of the blood and the heart and may increase the rate of heart disease. And that diagram there shows that one of the things that happens is that the platelets, which are important for blood clotting and those kinds of things, actually get stickier when exposed to smoke and so can pile up and then predispose people to a heart attack. Those that already have heart disease are at increased risk of suffering a heart attack or stroke from being exposed to secondhand smoke. And a couple of community-wide studies have shown that when citywide ordinances or community-wide bans went into effect, that actually heart attack admissions into hospitals decreased. So this kind of ordinance did have an effect that way. And it causes acute respiratory symptoms. And that's the diagram there of the two bronchial tubes. One is a normal one, the lighter pink, and then the darker pink you can see. That's normal. And then the other one is what happens in the case of an asthmatic. And, you know, wheezing means that the air can't be pushed out or it's pushed out through a smaller tube. And smoking, the immediate effects then are that it can trigger asthma attacks in both adults and children. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware, but 10% of adults in Oregon suffer from asthma and 8% of children. So the number of people suffering from this is not small. So the scientific evidence that is that there is no risk-free level of exposure to secondhand smoke. And even breathing a little bit of secondhand smoke can be deleterious to your effect. So finally, I'd like to address a little bit about smoke exposure in the workplace. The workplace is a major source of exposure to secondhand smoke for those working in these environments. Now, we're lucky here in Oregon, again, that we've passed legislation in 2001 that it covered 95% of our workers. But what about those 5% who aren't covered? That amounts to around 35,000 people still exposed in the workplace. And blue-collar service employees are less likely than white-collar indoor workers to be covered by these policies. So people like restaurant workers, people who are working in bars, bartenders, including people like musicians or stand-up comedians, are all forced to be exposed to smoke in the workplace. And some kids, of course, bowling alleys, we're talking about workers, but kids can be exposed in that process as well. There are an estimated 18,000 non-smoking women in Oregon of childbearing age who are exposed in their workplace, and that increases the risk of some of the childhood effects like low birth weight babies and SIDS. And we can't, as was mentioned, assume that workers can easily get other healthy jobs. A lot of these people are living in a smaller community, and there may only be one place of employment. It may be a restaurant-bar combination where smoking is allowed in the bar. And it's clear, again, from the Surgeon General's report that non-smoking areas do not help, that air circulates throughout a room. And so having a bar designated, even if it's adults owner only and posted for no minors, it can still have exposure to people working throughout. So in summary, this very large report concludes that smoke-free workplaces, totally smoke-free, are the only effective way. Ventilating, cleaning the air, those kinds of things do not protect workers and others from secondhand smoke exposure. And as mentioned already, we really believe that the smoke-free workplace laws do not harm business. That's been shown in a number of other places, that in addition to more people, the people who attend currently go to bars or these venues will continue to come. Many of us who don't smoke or don't want to see go and hear music in a smoke-filled bar now start to go to these. And other things that haven't been talked about, things like smoke damage to the facility, insurance policies for smokers who are out more, the health effects. Those are all actually improved business once this is adopted. So again, I'd be open to answering any of your questions, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
You will hold questions to the end. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Donald Austin. I'm a professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine in the School of Medicine at OHSU. I have a master's degree in public health and a master's degree in microbiology, but I'm not here representing OHSU. I'm here representing the Oregon Public Health Association. I'm a member of the board and a member of the policy committee for that organization. So I'm testifying on behalf of hundreds of public health workers and public health academicians who have the health and the welfare of Oregonians as their personal and professional commitment. And we strongly urge the passage of Senate Bill 571. I'd like to present to the committee the results of an air quality study that was done in a sample of bars in 12 Oregon communities. You have a copy of this in your red packet. It's on the left-hand side. This was carried out by American Cancer Society volunteers who were trained by members of the Department, State Department of Health. And to use an air sampler. This air sampler is this nice little device down here. It's called the TSI SidePack Personal Aerosol Monitor. And this device measures concentrations of particulate matter in the air, little particles that are smaller than 2.5 microns. To give you an idea of that size, you could, if you took a hair out, human hair, cut it in half, you could line up about five of those across the diameter of a hair. This is a particle size that is dangerous to inhale, with higher concentrations being more hazardous. The EPA's air quality index for particulate matter is based on these particles, and that index has six levels, which you can see from this nice little color graph. You may not be able to read the wording, but the you can read the fact that the high one is hazardous. And this is what they announced, the health warnings over television if particulate matter gets very high. With the collaboration of scientists from Roswell Park Cancer Institute, that's in Buffalo, New York, half-hour samples that were randomly collected from randomly selected bars in these 12 communities were analyzed and the results sent back. The level of indoor air pollution was 622% higher in those places allowing smoking than in those places where smoking was prohibited. An average of eight facilities in one community reached the hazardous level threshold. At a level, that average was at a level that was 40% over the minimum threshold for the hazardous level. And four more communities of the facilities tested, with facilities numbering from 5 to 27, average very unhealthy. That's the next to the hazardous part.
and only two of the 12 communities average good or moderate air qualities in their bars. And you might guess where those are. Those are Eugene and Corvallis, both of which have smoke-free ordinances protecting workers and patrons. So we know that environments with high levels of these particulate matters are hazardous, and that we can easily protect against them. No Oregon worker should be forced to accept exposure to a preventable hazard in the workplace as a condition of employment. Whether that hazard is benzene or asbestos or carbon monoxide or secondhand smoke. Making our workplaces smoke-free from tobacco smoke protects smokers and non-smokers alike. And there's one more point I'd like to make. We know that the attack rates in Pueblo, Colorado dropped by nearly 30% after the city passed a smoke-free ordinance. In Helena, Montana, there was a significant drop in heart attacks following a smoke-free ordinance. And the same thing has been reported from northern Italy when they instituted a smoking ban there, a public area smoking ban. In Albany, New York, a survey of non-smoking bar and restaurant workers before and after the implementation of the smoke-free ordinance found a dramatic change in the reported symptoms of sore throat, going from a prevalence of 42 to 17%, runny and irritated noses from 54% to 12%, and red itchy eyes going from 67% to 25%, accompanied by a 78% decline in cotinine in the saliva. Cotinine is that chemical that is a breakdown product of nicotine. Just this month, some researchers who analyzed cotinine in the blood of non-smoking participants in the NHANES 3 study, this is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, found that the level of cotinine in the blood of non-smokers was correlated with the level of two major predictors of heart disease. Now, the point of citing these examples is to emphasize that exposure to smoke in the workplace today increases the chance of a heart attack today. It increases acute respiratory problems today, and ear and throat irritation today, as well as increasing the long-term risk for lung cancer. So the Oregon Public Health Association urges passage of Senate Bill 571 without delay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wendy Watson.
Hi there. I do have some things, little packets for you as well.
And your name for the record, if you would. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Jenny Burdick, Vice Chair Fire, and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Wendy Watson. I live at 33604 Indian Drive in Coburg, Oregon. And I've been working in the bar industry for 17 years. 7 years ago, before Eugene's smoke-free work ordinance, I collected 100 signatures from restaurant and bar servers in Eugene that supported the idea of having a smoke-free workplace. I've compiled, what you have there is interviews that I compiled regarding Eugene's smoke-free workplace ordinance from those who were affected by it the most: servers, bartenders, the owners and managers, and some of the family members. Since they all can't be here, let me tell you a little bit about them. Okay. First off, there's Dave Lawrence. Dave is the bar manager at Chantrell's Restaurant. In 2001, he was named Best Bartender in Town by Eugene Weekly's People's Choice Award. About the ordinance, he says, it's had a positive influence on my health regarding the amount of sickness that I incur and the duration of the illness that I do get. When it went into effect, it had a negligible effect on my income that was ultimately offset by increased food sales and people staying longer. The same thought is echoed by Jeff Morgenthaler, who pre-ordinance worked at some of the smokiest places in town, like the Vets Club, the Tiny Tavern, and the Black Forest. He says that business is better because we have finally enticed the subset of people who never went out to bars because of the smoke. Those people are now coming out to drink, and if anything, has made the bar seen in this town more lively. Lindbergh's two boys are no longer worried about their mom dying of lung cancer while being both a restaurant server by day and a jazz singer at night. And Adrian and Aaron, they were finally able to quit smoking in preparation for their new baby because there's no longer a steady stream of secondhand smoke at work, trying to tear down the resolve to quit. Rick Lee, he was the manager of a local brewery when the smoke-free ordinance went into effect. He does state that there was a week or two of lagging lottery sales, mm-hmm. and adds that the sales soon returned to normal. Christy Joe, who works at Sixth Street Grill, she's just happy not to get burned by a customer's cigarette while trying to do her job. Mm-hmm.
I've recorded just a few of these in the presentation of the many people affected by the right to breathe clean air. These stories are about real people. Some are your neighbors. Some could be the guy that makes you your perfect Friday after work margarita. Some of them could be your best friend's daughter making some extra cash for last year of college. And maybe it was you before you are where you are right now. All I ask is for the same protection that you would give an office worker that was told there was a cancer-causing agent in their office. Would you make sure that they were protected, or would you ask them to change careers if they didn't like it? Lastly, I would like to commend Eugene City Council for taking care of us, the restaurant and bar industry workers against secondhand smoke, and letting us know that we're as important to protect as any other worker. I ask this committee to do the same for the rest of my fellow service employers in the state and protect them as well. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for compiling this. You're doing very good, very well at keeping on schedule, and if you run a minute or so over, we will give the other panel an extra minute. Welcome, Dr. Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm sitting in the wrong place, or maybe...
Your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Martin Jones, and I'm a physician in Eugene. I've been practicing internal medicine for about 30 years here. I live at 2300 Parkside Lane. I'm here to in support of Senate Bill 571 to ban smoking in all workplaces. And as has been mentioned, the law is not a prohibitionist law. It doesn't prohibit people from smoking. What it does do is just protect the health of others. I'm sitting in a good place and maybe the wrong place, and much of what I had to say was already been said, and I might just repeat a few things, and thank you very much. So well said. All workers deserve a safe, healthy workplace. In a working environment. No worker should have to risk getting cancer or having a heart attack to hold a job. As you've heard, there's such strong scientific evidence, I won't repeat it, the fact that there are over 800 deaths in this state currently because of exposure to secondhand smoke is something we can do something about. I want to say a little bit about coronary heart disease. Much has already been said. If you're a person who's exposed to secondhand smoke, your risk of a fatal heart attack or non-fatal heart attack is increased about 30% in the studies that were quoted. This happens because of small exposures to environmental tobacco smoke rapidly increase platelet aggregation. That's one of the clotting factors in our blood. And what happens is these platelets get sticky on just even 30-minute exposure to cigarette smoke. They therefore cause a thrombosis or a clot, which then clogs a blood vessel. And we see this happening. Scientific data suggests that even eating dinner in a smoky restaurant can actually precipitate a heart attack in a non-smoker. And then non-smokers that are chronically exposed to secondhand smoke have higher levels of those blood chemistry values that we can measure that are associated with heart attacks. And those include C-reactive protein. There are about 10 inflammatory measures that you can measure in someone's blood that we know are associated with coronary disease. We only measure one of these clinically at the labs called C-reactive protein. Maybe you've had it done on yourself. We know that those levels are elevated. We also know that levels of LDL or bad cholesterol, homocysteine, and fibrinogen go up. All those can lead to clotting. So I won't. You've heard what the U.S. Surgeon General has had to say, and basically this is a major, completely preventable public health hazard that we can do something about. And now that 16 other states have passed similar legislation, it's time we join them, because every day that we wait, every day that we procrastinate passing this means that another citizen's health is impaired or they're risking their life. So there is no safe exposure level for environmental tobacco smoke. I ask you to do the right thing and pass Senate Bill 571. I mentioned quickly about the 25 feet versus 10 feet. I would just say that because of this short-term exposure to smoke causing rise in these factors which cause clotting, removing people away from the entrances of buildings is so very important. And I would urge you to pass the 25-foot law as incorporated in Senate Bill 571. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You finished on time. Very, very good. Now we'll have a period of time for questions from the panel, and that won't count against anybody's time. The questions of this panel? Senator Walker.
Thank you. I'm not sure who will answer this, but I read in your materials and heard your testimony that there are 800 deaths per year in Oregon, but no one really talked about how many people are getting medical care as a result of smoking and secondhand smoke, and that might be a little harder to determine. because there are a number of illnesses that can be caused by exposure to smoke. So one of the medical people want to respond to that?
The question was asked of the state, can you put a price to secondhand smoke like you do with tobacco products? We say by smoking, the true price of tobacco should be $11.16 a pack to really recoup all the costs that we as taxpayers spend on health issues. You can't really do that with secondhand smoke. However, on a national level, the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids has put a number together that nationwide secondhand smoke illnesses cost the nation $10 billion a year.
Okay. Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll just sort of echo that. It's always hard to put an exact price tag, because usually when people are in the hospital or with some of these smoke-related illness, they have a variety of things, so how much you attribute to one or the other. It may be that the smoking or the secondhand smoke exposure is what puts them over the edge, if you will. We estimate that in Oregon, tobacco use in general cost us over $2 billion. $1 billion of that is in direct medical care. And then there's also lost productivity. So we haven't talked about people who have an asthma attack, don't need to be in the hospital, don't seek that kind of care, but stay home from work, let's say, or have an upper respiratory infection that they stay home from work. The deaths related to tobacco overall or direct use is about 7,000, whereas the secondhand smoke is about, it's a little over a tenth of that, 800. So if you make some analogy, you could still estimate that it's on the order of several hundred million dollars that we relate to both direct medical and indirect medical or indirect costs like lost productivity.
I just have one question of Ms. Wally. I haven't seen you since my first election. I knocked on Wendy's door when I was first running for office. I'm so glad you're active, and I really appreciate what you put together here. This is very nice. And I think in one of these I was reading, this person has to spend a lot on their clothing because before smoking ordinance went into effect, because they had to go home and the clothes, after a while, you can't wear them. They get cigarette burns or nicotine stains, so that too is just another factor to take into place when someone works around smoke.
The other thing you were talking about,
when you were talking about people's health and how much it costs, servers, as a rule, we don't have insurance. And so a lot of times we're white-knuckling it, or we're giving up, you know, we're taking on an extra shift so we can pay for to go to the doctor the next time. So a lot of this isn't, the servers who make, you know, less and who are having the worst shifts, which sometimes are the shifts that are the late night shifts, the ones where there is more smoke, those people are on the Oregon Health Plan, some of them are. So, I mean, it really is costing because we don't have insurance.
Very good point. Thank you.
I don't know if anybody on the council, on the panel here can respond to this, but the Occupational Safety and Health Administration at the national level and at the state level has pretty tight regulations on pollutants in manufacturing plants and you know, places that work with benzene and arsenic and that type of chemical. Is there anybody here who can comment on how you could get the kind of hazardous pollution that Hillsborough, for example, has on the average of 350 doodahs, whatever they are, as compared to 9 in Corvallis, which is a healthy level of these indoor pollutants? Can anybody comment on how this could be in any of our workplaces, given that we have workplace regulators in place?
Madam Chair, those regulations just simply don't address tobacco smoke.
Thank you for getting that on the record. There's also no safety regulations at all pertaining to tobacco. There are all kinds of safety regulations in place, but tobacco is exempt from all.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Well, I would like to welcome your very own senator, Senator Bill Morissette, who has joined us on the panel today. And Senator Morissette, briefly, Senator Morissette, I'd invite you to ask questions. I don't know how much you heard of this, but...
Am I going to get a chance to...
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, wait.
Okay.
But I want Martin to stick around.
He wants a doctor's appointment.
Why not?
My district.
Okay, I was worried about this. For the record, I too am a duck. Did you have a question, Senator Pazanski? Okay, thank you.
Just taking ownership.
Turf battle all over the place. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, for our next panel, we will have Bill Perry, Jack Elder, Don Smith, and Ken Buckles. This is the panel in opposition to these bills. Bill,
yes.
Bill, would you mind if Senator Morrison spoke first briefly? Your call. No, your call. Okay, we'll wait.
Do you want him to come here?
No, he can just testify. Yeah. Audience, Senator Morissette, as it turns out, has a conflict in his schedule, so he will be speaking briefly before the panel in opposition speaks. And thank you, Mr. Perry.
That means he's going to oppose the bill.
No, that does not mean he's going to oppose the bill. One of the bills is his.
Beaver. Oh, he's got his beaver.
Well, and thank you very much, panel, for allowing this deviation in our schedule. Welcome to the committee, Senator Morissette.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee. I think he ought to be disqualified. Right off the bat, he's got a beaver tie on.
Orange shirt.
Orange. Oh. He really knows how to make points.
We gave him immunity for the day.
Thank you very much. My testimony will be brief.
Even though you own this district,
yeah,
you still have to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yourself.
Excuse me. Senator Bill Morissette, District 6. Thank you. That it does include this building. Across the street, it's Floyd's district.
Thank you. We already went through this.
My wife and I both have been impacted by smoke. We didn't know it at the time, but we know it now. And that's why I wanted Dr. Martin Jones to be here, so he is my wife's doctor, and so I want him to know some of this information. Secondhand smoke is linked to nasal sinus cancer. Actually, different kinds of cancer: cervix, breast, bladder, chronic coughing, phlegm, wheezing, chest disorder, lower lung function, severe respiratory tract infections such as bronchitis or pneumonia. I had bronchitis for years. Every single winter I would get bronchitis. I would go to my doctor immediately. I would get an antibiotic, and that usually took care of it. I had pneumonia for 6 weeks one time. I didn't connect it with smoking. I haven't had any problems since I've quit smoking. The only carryover is that my throat gets tight when I smell secondhand smoke. I do have a reaction. As far as I know, I don't have any of the lingering illnesses. Asthma, eye, nose irritation, severe chronic heart infections in children, sudden death, infant death syndrome, low birth rate, small birth size for babies of women who expose to secondhand smoke during pregnancy. We have 8 living children. We've had 11 children altogether. We lost 3 children. Premature birth. Actually, after our first child, which was normal weight, all of the children up until the last 2 were underweight. 3 of them premature, 3 of them lived for a matter of days in an incubator and died. When we moved to Eugene from Portland, my wife went to Dr. Woodward. She was pregnant, and he looked at her record and said, "I'm not going to deal with you unless you quit smoking." That was fairly early in her pregnancy. She quit smoking. Our last 2 children were normal weight and survived. So I understand the impact of smoking and secondhand smoke personally. So I do support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And thank you, panel, for your patience. You will have an extra 2 minutes if you need it.
Okay, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Oregon State, or for Oregon State. I'm going to say that she's got me down here to be on the defensive. I've accused her of that. For the Oregon Restaurant Association, and I'm also on the Executive Committee of the Alumni Association for OSU, so I'll just put that on the record also. We at the Restaurant Association passed the 2001 law that banned smoking in 95% of the workplaces, and I'm going to sit here and tell you that cigarette smoke's bad for you firsthand, secondhand. I'm not going to sit here and debate any of those issues because, you know, we understand smoking. We've been taught since kids that smoking's bad. When we passed the law, one of the things that we did, there were four jurisdictions that banned smoking in bars. Benton County as a whole, Corvallis obviously started and then expanded, Eugene, St. Helens, and Tillamook. When we passed the statewide compromise legislation that basically said that bars and bingo halls and a few others were protected, actually St. Helens removed their bar ban and came back to the statewide standard. Tillamook removed their bar ban and came back to the statewide standard. So I think there are several examples where the compromise is working. You know, I understand people don't like cigarette smokes, but I think the compromise works. And I basically want to discuss three fundamental points today. As you can see in my testimony, first of all, you know, once you take kids out of the equation, adults should be free to make their own decisions, and the marketplace is going to determine legal products. I mean, that's a fundamental principle, I think, of most retail businesses. The second is if you pass a statewide total ban, there will be financial consequences to both me and the state. You guys writing the state's budget, you're going to end up having to deal with them on some level also. And there are a specific issue, bans in the urban area, that I will kind of talk about the 10-foot, 25 feet, but it will create some problems in highly dense populated areas if you kick smokers out on the street from bars after 10 o'clock at night, and there are issues that need to be dealt with there from a OLCC licensee perspective. So the first point, adults making their own decisions. I think the current law is working for smoking patrons and non-smoking patrons. You find more and more bars in Oregon going smoke-free today. Generally, it's been the microbrews, some of those, what I would say, cottage industries. They found that they can go smoke-free, and it has been profitable for them. So people making their decision, and basically their customers and their employees helping them with that decision sell it, has shown that it can happen, and it can be profitable. So I think there are examples to where bars have gone smoke-free, where that need to be dealt with there from a OLCC licensee perspective. So the first point, adults making their own decisions. I think the current law is working for smoking patrons and non-smoking patrons. You find more and more bars in Oregon going smoke-free today. Generally, it's been the microbrews, some of those, what I would say, cottage industries. They've found that they can go smoke-free, and it has been profitable for them. So people making their decision, and basically their customers and their employees helping them with that decision, sell it, has shown that it can happen, and it can be profitable. So I think there are examples to where bars have gone smoke-free where it's been profitable. On the converse side, when it's largely forced upon everybody, there's examples where it hasn't been profitable. The first one, if you look on page 3 of my testimony, or in my packet, the first page of my non-testimony, the bottom, I'm bad at right and left. I think it's the right-hand corner that lists the financial statistics. This was done by the Oregon Health Division in 1999 after the Corvallis ban. And when you look at in that little grid at the bottom, customer counts were down, monthly gross receipts were down, monthly food receipts were down, monthly alcohol receipts were down, and monthly video gaming receipts are down. Then you go 2 pages back from that, also the same Health Division study where they did Albany. You didn't see an increase in Albany. Things relatively stayed the same. Monthly gross receipts are about the same. Customer counts are about the same. Food receipts are about the same. Alcohol receipts are about the same. Actually, video poker went up $500 a month in Albany. Also attached on the back 2 pages, I actually just printed out a sheet of Corvallis retailers the year before and Corvallis lottery retailers the year after. You had a 30% drop overnight. Video poker receipts declined. I also pointed, there's little arrows there that show 5 retailers that are just outside the jurisdiction, which I would say are drivable. They had a slight increase. It was about 20%. But those are small retailers. There wasn't a transition. So I think what this shows is when you ban smoking in adult establishments, there are negative impacts. There's not a transfer. It's just been a negative impact. Also, on my testimony, and these, I'm going to quote some numbers so you follow along. The first full paragraph on the second page of my testimony. When you look at Albany per capita video play, there's about $208 per capita per person per year. That's your lottery play. In Corvallis, it's $66 per capita per year. When you go down to Springfield, you have about $396 worth of lottery play per capita per year. And in Eugene, you have $157 per capita per year. So you see that these jurisdictions that are next to each other, your video play are down. Okay, so I'm not going to sit here and tell you, you're looking at $1 billion worth of lottery that you're in the process of budgeting next budget cycle, about $1 billion a year. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I think it's going to be the 30% reduction that you saw in Corvallis or the potential 40% reduction when you're looking at a per capita, but I think you would be remiss if you didn't at least look at about a 10 to 15% reduction in your lottery play. And in essence, what I'm saying is you can't say, I want the smoking ban and not budget for it. If you're going to ban it, you need to remember that you need to budget that there's going to be a loss in revenue. And I don't think anything you've seen from a gaming perspective, you know, you have to account for that. I just think you have to. And I would say that as we look at the lottery, liquor, health division studies, you have never seen anything that's been a total ban has been profitable for anybody. I mean, just from the stuff we've seen in Oregon, you can't say that it's been profitable for anybody. And then finally, the enforcement problems. One of the 10-foot rule is going to be an issue. And the big problem, about 24% of the population smoke. That's a guesstimate, and I don't think anybody necessarily agrees with that. But when you look at after 10 o'clock at night, it almost flips. You have about 60% of the people that are bars are out at night smoke. And so what happens is when you look in the urban areas like the Pearl District, Northwest 23rd, if you start kicking those people out in the street, there's going to be basically be problems. I mean, we've all seen the problems that come up in the Oregonia from time to time about ruckuses raised in the neighborhood because of bar patrons and some other things. Obviously, as a bar owner, I have an ability to control my crowd if you keep them inside. And I would say if you talk to several bar owners, a lot of times because people go in and out of the establishment, what they say is, you know, I don't care what you're doing. You leave twice, you stay out, you don't come back in. It gives you an ability to control your crowd. One of the problems that this would exist was that I'm going to have to let smokers go outside if you ban smoking. So that's going to create problems in the street, on the back deck, or anything else. And obviously from a 25-foot perspective or the 10-foot perspective, the farther you push them away from my doorway, the more difficult it is for me to control that crowd. I mean, it's just a fundamental principle. If my bouncer can't stand by the front door and kind of help control the crowd, then it's going to be harder for us to control them, and we have to keep our liquor license. And so I would just plead with you, if you're going to make them go outside, you know, let me put them on the back deck, let me do some different things, but the farther you push them away from the doorway, the more difficult it is for my operators to try to control the crowd. So with that, I don't think I took more than 10 minutes, but I'd like to have the other panelists go, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have copies of mine and my two cohorts here, testimony, and then I also have letters of support, and whom do I give those to?
Our assistant will pick them up.
Okay. These are who will be testifying, three stacks. And these are backups from other nonprofits. Okay. Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of I've forgotten where I am already. Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Jack Elder. I'm with the Oregon Charitable Gaming Association. I am the chair of that organization. Normally I speak extemporaneously, but because this was too important, I had to write it down. So I'll sometimes be reading and sometimes be talking. But what I wanted to do was lay the groundwork here, because I've got 5 minutes and each of my fellow bingo game charities will be talking about what their games do. Essentially, we have in the state of Oregon, charitable gaming is a way that we have for fundraising for our charities. Of the licensees, they are licensed by Class A's to Class D's. Class A's are the big ones. They're the ones that operate multiple times per year, have larger amounts of money. Class D's are all the way down to where they're only operating one time a year. In those groups, there are many who operate in non-smoking facilities, but all of the big games in total do allow smoking in their bingo halls. When it comes to the bills that are before you, we're concerned that the exemption that we currently have might be eliminated, and it will have deep ramifications in our fundraising. Of the 33 games that are currently operating, about six of them are in jeopardy right now. One of the discussions that I put in here is that the legislature passed this law in 87 and allowed us to continue to operate. The Department of Justice was given the duty to oversee and basically license us and to do the administrative work that is to make certain that we maintain our agreement. In doing so, they established rules. And the rules that they established, the ones that are really the numbers, and this is where I really want you to bear with me, is that currently the Department of Justice requires that we not have more than 18% expenses when we operate bingo. Now, that 18% is just for paying for the heat, lights, rent, the various other hard, you know, the bingo supplies, things along that line. They also mandate that we have a minimum 5% that goes to our nonprofits. Well, that's 18 and 5. Where's all the rest of the money? Well, the bingo market demands that we return somewhere between 70 and 75% to the players. The players expect that. They're not going to come in and play unless they're going to get a return on what they're playing. So if you add together the 75, the 18, and the 5, you come out to 98%. That doesn't leave us much wiggle room. If you're looking at an average bingo hall, you're looking at 175 to 225 people in there on an average day or evening. Now, the last 25 people through the door are the profit. That's about 11% or 14% of the total players in the building. Well, according to a study that was done, and this was included in the Multnomah County Economic Impact on Bingo study that was done 4 years ago in 2003, data from communities in Ontario, Canada, showed that they had a drop of 34% of their players per session. 34%. Now, if you pass this and we can't have smoking, this is what's going to happen. There will be some people who won't play bingo anymore. 60 to 70% of our players smoke. We don't agree with that. Fact is, we would prefer that they also eat better. I tried to feed them better food when I ran a bingo hall. I tried to put better food on the menu. They wouldn't buy it. They're going to do what they want to do. If they can't smoke in our bingo halls, they're not going to attend. Now, if this happens, whether it's 34% or 11% or 14%, some of these games will fail. The charities that operate this funding source will no longer have the funding source. If they don't have the funding source, they won't be able to provide services, give the money away, do whatever they do in the local communities. Now, we realize that's an impact of a law. We realize that. But nevertheless, we're pleading with you. You know, we as charities are not bad people. We try to give money away all the time. If we make it, we give it away. The one thing we're very proud of is we make our money. We don't beg for it. Some of us do go out and ask for donations, but some of us have bingo as our only funding source. And we turn around and give away hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, sometimes millions of dollars a year. My organization, over a 15-year time period, has passed through over $1 million. That's important to sports in Oregon. And quite frankly, we can't get the money any other place because we fall in the line way behind those who are taking care of health, education, children, homeless, various others. When we get in line and we ask for people to donate money, they go, wait a minute, I've got sick kids up front here. You wait, you go to the rear. Frequently, they never get to us. So we make our money from there. So what we ask of you is that when you consider passing a law, that you look closely at whether or not you're going to continue the exemption. This is very important. It's going to impact our communities in Oregon for a long period of time. Thank you.
Who's next?
Let me go. All right. Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Ken Buckles. I'm a PE teacher at Milwaukee High School for 27 years, also former head football coach, assistant wrestling and track, and I teach weightlifting full-time. I'm also the executive director of Remembering America's Heroes, and I oppose the current bills, all three of them, and support the current exemption for bingo halls because the impact on this ban will end my small nonprofit mission and existence, and I strongly believe our mission is extremely important. Our mission is to honor veterans and provide education to the youth and the community so they can understand and appreciate the value of freedom and its cost. In November of 2000, I rented out the Memorial Coliseum and involved over 25 high schools, choirs, and bands, and recreated a USO show and honored several thousand veterans. The following year, 2001, we honored over 4,000 veterans with the USO show at the Rose Garden Arena. It was a tremendous success, over 10,000 people in attendance. Again, a choir of over 600, a high school all-star band of 250. But it left me personally with $150,000 of debt. A Vietnam veteran, Jim Page, stated that this event healed him and changed his life and said, let's form a nonprofit, Remembering America's Heroes, so that what you do at Milwaukee High School
can expand throughout the state and reach kids and veterans. It was at about the same time that the Disabled American Veteran Bingo Hall in Portland offered us a slot. And thank God they did, because revenues from this bingo operation has allowed us to expand our programs throughout the state of Oregon. We've done Living History Days at Milwaukee High for 11 years. We've done them at high schools around the state. We bring veterans, Holocaust survivors, refugees into the classroom. We serve them lunch. We recreate a USO show and recognize and honor them. We are able to fly in famous veterans and Holocaust survivors from around the United States, Tuskegee Airmen, Navajo Code Talkers, to all these schools. We're going to Dayton High School in 3 weeks for the first time, and we're bringing in about 10 famous veterans from around the country that are all in their 80s, and we're losing them fast. The Oregon State Fair came to us last year and said, will you please take our opening weekend and do what you do at the opening weekend. It was such a huge success, they've asked us to come back for 3 years, recreate everything. Plus, we offer a military vehicle, indoor and outdoor display. We have two displays. It took 3 years for our high school kids to build this. We collected pop tabs to represent an American killed in action from the American Revolution to the current war in Iraq and Afghanistan. They are bound on wire, strung like, if you can picture, blinds up and down, 34x8 panels that's over 75 yards long. That's been on display around the state. We call it the High Cost of Freedom. 4 years ago, some high school students started a project that they still are working on and adding every day. They download pictures and personal information on all who have been killed in Afghanistan and Iraq. It is now on 12 6-foot by 10-foot panels, which we've taken to the Oregon State Fair. We are asked, Milwaukee kids have been asked, choirs, bands, everything, to be involved in Veterans Day and Memorial Days for the last 6 years. I have been personally honored and recognized at the White House by President Clinton, remembering America's Heroes, Milwaukee High, and Living History Day. The impact on this event has been phenomenal. Many, and I could say hundreds, of veterans talked about their experiences for the first time to students and the horrors of war in the classroom, and it has led to them getting post-traumatic stress counseling. Many have said it's a healing experience. Dozens of schools or students have learned for the first time that Dad was a Vietnam vet. He never talked about it. Grandpa was a World War II vet. He never talked about it. I could relate hundreds of moving stories that would bring everyone in this room to tears, but I know we don't have the time. I just wish you could understand how important this has meant to thousands of students throughout Oregon, and hopefully thousands more, because I want, my mission is to spread it, and veterans. I currently have 8 employees at the Bingo Hall, and most all of them are single mothers. This is their only source of income. They're wonderful ladies. God, I love them. By the way, all of them smoke. I have a single mother who runs my office, Remembering America's Heroes, which is stationed at Milwaukee High School. This is her only source of income. So the ripple effect of this smoking ban in a bingo hall will have an effect on our nonprofit. And last, I'd like to tell you two little quick stories and show you the importance of this. 1995, when I wanted to sell this concept to teachers and administrators, I did a survey. Now, I remember this obviously for 9/11, Iraq, Afghanistan, but this was before Saving Private Ryan came out, which increased awareness. This was before the World War II Memorial. This was before Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, and I had a survey in the high school of 1,200 students. What is a veteran? And what is Veterans Day? The number one answer, veterans take care of dogs and cats. And Veterans Day is just another day to sleep in. Ever since that first Living History Day and all the other high schools, the answer now is veterans are our heroes. At every school, I tell them, it's important that you dress and wear your nicest clothes to show respect for these veterans when they come to your campus. Well over 80% of the boys wear ties, take off their hats, take off their sagging pants. Girls wear their dresses. Years ago, a girl from Milwaukee High whose regular attire was green mohawk spike hair, nose ring, tongue ring, lip ring with a chain from her lip to her ear and clothes to match her appearance, walked up to me Living History Day, beautifully dressed, hair, everything, and said, "Don't you recognize me?" And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't." Says, "I'm the green hair monster." Said, "Veterans deserve this. That's why I'm doing it today." The very next day, she was in her usual attire. I guess, you know, I don't deny the impressive testimony. I'm not a smoker. I never have been. But I know, as he said, we're so small, and we do, every year we do everything. Auctions, donations, everything. And we don't have the revenue. It would be over. And I enjoy what I do. I love teaching. I love teaching weightlifting. I'd rather be in that weight room right now with the teenagers in here. But it's been an amazing impact, and I'm very grateful for Don Smith of the Disabled American Chapter that gave us this opportunity. But thank you for this time.
And thank you for all you do. It's amazing to find time to teach with everything else you're doing. Welcome.
Thank you. Can I ask you for a time check? How much do we have?
You have 10 minutes.
I won't be using all of that.
Actually, 9 minutes.
Okay. That's a little bit less. Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Don Smith. I'm the Executive Director for Disabled American Veterans Portland Chapter 1. I just want to kind of get off of my letter here for a second and just explain who I am. I'm a Navy veteran. I messed up my knee while I was in, never saw any action. And I also am not a smoker. Actually, I rode the last two cycle Oregons. I'm training for this one. I've done about 7,000 miles in the last 2 years. But I run a bingo hall, and the reason I do is it provides for people who can't get it any other way. And I'm going to have a hard time not getting emotional over this because it's a pretty heartfelt subject. I'm deeply conflicted over this. Let me go back to my letter. On the way here today, I have to stop in Santa Clara to visit a Vietnam vet who recently attempted to take his own life. This is the second time in 2 months. The reason, the VA withheld disability payment to repay an overpayment some 8 years ago. The first time this happened, this guy lost his home. They foreclosed on him and took it, the bank. The VA disability payments were interrupted and a bank foreclosed. What's this have to do with smoking? Well, the money we make from charitable gaming goes directly to aiding our vets. We're able to save this veteran from eviction, help save his daughter's mental health program, turn his water and power back on, and ultimately save or delay the taking of his own life. Who will do this kind of thing if this money dries up? As a veteran, he depends on the VA healthcare system. As many of you know, the VA system is broken. Even before the latest military conflict, the VA was overwhelmed. While there are many good people in the VA, they simply cannot handle the load.
Thanks. Sorry about that.
A contribution to the common space in my committee.
Oh, wow. I apologize. I thought I had that off. Sorry for the interruption.
That's all right. So, there are a lot of good people in the VA, but they're just simply overwhelmed. They were overwhelmed before we got into Iraq, and mental health is the one that's really taxing them. They don't even know how to treat this stuff as it's coming back. While there are many good people, the veterans are being denied health care due to backlogs and inadequately staffed case review teams. So here's a short list of things we do with our bingo money. In Snowmass, Colorado, every year is the DAV Winter Sports Clinic. If any of you have ever seen it, it's where they teach them to ski. You've probably seen a single ski, and they're sitting on it, booking down a mountain. This is where we teach paralyzed and amputee vets to ski, scuba, rock climb, fence, and much more. These vets learn that life in a wheelchair need not be an end, but a beginning. This year, we're lucky to fund the expenses for 8 vets and 2 spouses to attend this life-changing event. I say life-changing as it changes many lives, those who participate and those lucky enough to be a spectator. If you ever get a chance, you ought to witness this in Snowmass. It's awesome. This year we'll be sending 5 veterans to the National Wheelchair Games in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Unless you've seen this kind of an event, you cannot imagine how life-changing and in many cases a life-saving experience for these veterans. They've given up. They're in a wheelchair. They think it's over. We teach them there's a whole bunch more to life. Thank you for the Kleenex. Last week, Davey Chapter 1 sent money to purchase 6 vans. You've probably seen the vans running them down I-5 with the star-spangled stripes on them, hauling vets back and forth. The VA doesn't pay for those vans. We do. We raise the money for those. We buy them. We do get some support from Ford and a trust in Colorado. But we train the drivers. We staff all those vans. And those vans don't just take DAV members. They take any veteran to an appointment that can't get there. We bought 6 of them this year with bingo money. There's about 18 of them, about 14 of them in the state. We replace them yearly. We are called upon to assist other agencies to help vets in need. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, various homeless shelters and other veterans groups, mental health professionals have all called on or referred vets to us when they didn't have any other way to take care of that veteran. All across the state, people know that the DAV can help in a pinch, and we are proud to do so. Should our game fail, so will we. And who will help our vets then? We fund the basic care items for the VA hospital patients. When many of these folks finally do get through the backlog and finally get an appointment, they're in such dire shape that they're often admitted into the hospital with no warning. We provide the toothpaste, the shampoo, the slippers, and the lap robes. These items are not included in VA health care. We also buy medical and exercise equipment for the VA hospitals, and we send VA nurses down to California to training classes that the VA can't afford for the spinal cord injury clinic. And much more. With bingo money, we're able to refurbish and loan out expensive medical equipment like electric scooters, oxygen generators to vets while they await the slow-moving VA. Simple items like walkers and shower chairs can make a world of a difference to a vet. Recently, we had a woman veteran come to our attention who could not get a wheelchair from her provider. This vet's daughter explained that her mom could not even get her to the bathroom on her own. They both cried when we gave them their medical equipment. Like many of our veterans, they were too proud and humiliated to ask for a handout. Like the vet I visited on the way here, and I will see him again on the way back, they've run out of options, and for many of them, a reason to live. Our work is important, and the proceeds from bingo are crucial. Our vets have fought for our freedoms, and they fought for the freedom to choose. Who is going to help those who fought and lost for our country if we lose this precious resource? Again, I totally agree with evidence. I definitely agree with evidence. I don't smoke. I'm very healthy. But we need this money. We need it badly. And it's the industry shrinking. We're getting attacked from lottery, casinos, and our own lawmaking. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions from the panel? Senator Walker?
Yes, in response to that last comment, Mr. Smith, are your revenues down generally for bingo? Smoking ban has an impact. Your revenues are just down, period, aren't they?
I would say that's a fact. We're looking at about a third of the operators who were here a year ago. With all respect to the former panel who said there was no impact on business, go to Vancouver and try to play bingo. We're enjoying a little bit of success right now because they're driving across the bridge, but that number is now dwindling. They've stopped coming. So I hope I answered your question.
You did. I have a follow-up question.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. Mr. Perry, you cited a study that I think is an old one. a follow-up question. Then go ahead, Paul. Okay. Mr. Perry, you started a study that I think is an old one.
Mm-hmm. 1999.
It's showing the effects of the smoking ban. I actually, Dale Penn, the director of the Oregon State Lottery, I think you were there that day. He was testifying in our Ways and Means Committee on the potential impact to the lottery of if we implement a smoking ban, and I challenged him on his statement. So he sent me in response some information that shows that, yeah, in Eugene the sales went down for the first 3 years, but last year they were up 8%, and this year they're on track at 20% increase. So can you explain how it is that you would see that the smoking ban has impacted Eugene negatively?
Senator Burdick, Senator Walker, actually it's kind of funny when you talk about Corvallis. Corvallis lagged behind their 1996 numbers when they banned it. They did not break their 1996 levels until we got line games. So I would generally say that when you look at line games over the last 2 years, that's given everybody a bump. But a year ago, people saw a 20% increase, and Eugene saw 8%. And obviously that is still growing. So I would say that line games has given you additional revenue. But at the same token, when you look at it per capita in the cities next door to them, it's down in both Corvallis and Eugene. And so, like I said, it's a guess number. But like I said, when you've seen the examples in the past, and I actually think that Eugene was only down about 24% as adverse to Corvallis, so 30% when they did their ban. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you there's going to be a 30% reduction, but I really think you're remiss if you don't say at least 10 to 15%, because every other jurisdiction, Canada or anybody else, where they've basically taken smoking away, there's been a reduction in gaming receipts. You know, bingo, I know that bingo operators want an exemption. I can tell you the horse track operators want an exemption. You know, so I think that anybody that's in the business is going to tell you that it's an issue. And I also, you know, want to say from the style of our gaming, meaning my members, not necessarily theirs, when you look at gaming, table games, meaning craps, blackjack, those tend not to be as smoker-heavy related. When you look at the small venues, smaller machine venues, those tend to be more smoker-related. So the formula we have for gaming in Oregon under the system is a little bit higher a rate of smoking as compared to other forms of gaming. So it's going to have a little bit more of an impact the way we've established our system.
Well, thank you for that explanation. For me, it's an easy call because I don't think the state of Oregon should be raking in money off of addictive behaviors. But I wanted to thank you for your charitable activities. You know, I think what you do is great and wonderful. It really is. I'm just opposed to the smoking aspect. So
may I respond to your addictive behavior comment? That's something that has always deeply troubled me, knowing that my nonprofit survives from gaming. But I spend an awful lot of time out there, and it's amazing. Most of those bingo players are gray-haired widows, and they budget their playing tightly, and they are some of the nicest people I've ever met, and this is truly their home. And I don't know about bingo. I know I've seen and read the stats on, you know, lottery poker and all that. But I don't see a lot of it in our hall. I see a lot of people that this is what they enjoy.
You have a different type of folk that plays the bingo, I think, than plays the lottery. And you're right, they tend to be older people who are very particular. They go through the bingo cards trying to find just the right one, even though they're the same ones. There might be a feel to it. Mm-hmm. I saw that recently at one of the senior centers when I served lunch, and they played bingo with their pennies. But, you know, it is a different class. It's just a different style of folks that play. This is more social activity for them, I think. All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I want to commend you, too, for the charitable activities. And just for the record, I think it was implicit in your testimony, especially I do Cycle Oregon, too.
All right.
And you know, at least two of the three of you are involved in fairly heavy physical endeavors that require very good health to engage in. So am I correct in assuming that if someone could wave a magic wand and you could get the support you need for your organizations without having smoking be an element, that your opposition would be withdrawn? Can you say that for the record?
Yeah, I strongly agree with you. I'm between a rock and a hard place. I've been in a restaurant business my whole life. I'm a hotel restaurant major. I've been in it. I don't smoke, but I do because I work in it. But we have no other way to raise this kind of money. And the industry is getting beat from all sides. What I hope you got from Jack Elder's testimony was that it's not so much we're afraid we won't be here in 5 years. It's that who will be here. It's probably going to take that last 25 groups we have and whittle it down to maybe 5 or 10. It's the ripple, the 12 to 18 months that we're afraid of.
Yeah, certainly nobody wants that outcome. Well, thank
Senator
you.
Burdick, just for the record, Bill Perry, again, I don't think anybody, even I would argue that. I don't think anybody up here is advocating for smoking, including myself. The issue is that smoking is a legal product, and so there are consumers that want to use it. If cigarettes were never invented, I don't think anybody would be up here saying that. But, I mean, the bottom line is, as you can see numbers, there are people that want to do it. And I don't think my members are out there saying we're advocating for smoking. It's just, it's a legal product. So in the industry, there's some people that basically are going to cater to those people because it's what it is. And I would say you don't need to limit it to their audience. You know, it's just, we're not advocating for smoking. It's just saying that it's a legal product and there are customers out there that want it. And that's the issue.
Okay, thank you. We need to move on, Senator Walker. A quick one.
Yes, just a quick response. You know, big tobacco studies have just shown that nicotine levels have increased 11% in cigarettes in the last 5 years. So big tobacco is making the money. And they're the cause of why people are developing these addictive behaviors. And you're just there as a restaurant in a bingo parlor to make money, but you do it in an environment that puts some people at risk when they're smoking. Thank you.
I will personally commit that if one of these bills goes through, I will personally commit to come and play bingo in a smoke-free environment.
Please call and let me know you're coming.
You can count on me. Thank you very much. Okay, we have about 15 or 16 people signed up, so we'll have time for everyone. If everyone can limit their comments to 2 or 3 minutes, and if someone else has said something that you agree with, feel free to associate yourself with that. We will start off with Wendy Bjornson of OHSU. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Wendy Bjornson. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University. And I wanted to speak today and present some testimony about what's happening at OHSU in support of extending the bans on smoking in workplaces and in public places. Just for background, I'm the director of the Smoking Cessation Center at OHSU and also served as the director of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon for a number of years during the time that these existing laws went into effect in Oregon. So I have a lot of familiarity with the non-smoking issues. Right now in Oregon at OHSU, my role is to help direct the policy change that will take our campus from a campus that permits smoking in designated areas to a campus that restricts smoking entirely. So this step from a partial to full ban on smoking was anticipated in 2001, which is when the current existing policy at OHSU went into effect. But now with the momentum that's been created by the increasingly strict restrictions on smoking in public and the conclusive evidence from the Surgeon General, which you heard about in some detail today, this is an important step for OHSC to take to really fulfill its mission as an institution of health and healing. So for a bit of background, OHSU is about 12,000 employees, and we see over 180,000, 5,000 patients every year. So we estimate that over 2,000 of our employees and about 44,000 of our patients use tobacco. In addition, we have many thousands of visitors to our campus every month, many of whom smoke. So even with our current policy restricting smoking to designated areas, there's a considerable amount of secondhand smoke on our campus. The smoke creates a health hazard, we believe, for our patients, employees, and the visitors to the campus, and leaves visitors with the impression that smoking is not a priority for treatment at OHSU. And so the president and the executive leadership at OHSU, together with a lot of us who work there and who work on this issue, strongly believe that it is time for a change. But our plan for, you've heard today about the consequences of passing these laws, and we're very aware of that at OHSU, and our plan for implementing the policy is really a compassionate one. We clearly recognize not only the health hazards of tobacco use and see those effects every day in our hospitals and our outpatient clinics, but we also recognize the profound dependence that's created by regular tobacco use. So it's not our intention to punish tobacco users, but rather to create a healthy environment for everyone who comes to our campus and to help those with the difficult addiction to tobacco to manage while they're there. We also plan to support any employee or patient who wants to stop with resources and services. We obviously agree with the trends in the general public to increasingly restrict exposure to smoke, but as an institution of healing, we also support appropriate treatment for those who need and want help. So it's not sufficient, we think, to just restrict smoking. It's necessary to also help people. Like every other place that's considered changing its tobacco use policies, we have received both substantial support and also criticism from our employees. Despite the obvious relationship, we think, between creating a smoke-free environment and in an institution of healing, many of our employees who smoke consider the new policy to be unfair to them and an unnecessary change. Further, since many of our patients and their families come to OHSU in considerable distress, some of our health professionals also question the wisdom of restricting smoking under these circumstances. But even so, we recognize that any policy that restricts or further restricts smoking will always be controversial, as we are finding in our own institution. At the same time, the health consequences of smoking and of secondhand smoking are significant, dangerous, and irrefutable. For all of these reasons, it's our view that we can no longer justify permitting smoking on our campus, and we strongly support increasing restrictions on smoking in public places for the health of all Oregonians. We also encourage the legislature to take a compassionate approach to these restrictions. So if these bills are passed, we really encourage the legislature to also support the state program to provide more treatment services for the many Oregonians who suffer from tobacco dependence at the same time these new restrictions go into effect. In this way, many more lives will be permanently protected and the health of all Oregonians will be improved significantly. I was very taken with the bar owner who was here and talked about not having health insurance and recognizing the impact that these restrictions have on a lot of people who don't have health insurance and who need to find treatment for tobacco. So really pairing the restrictions with a compassionate look at how to help people, we really strongly support. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel?
Thank you.
Okay, Stephen Lepinen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Lepinen. I live at 280 Conestoga Way in Ms. Walker's district, or she's in mine, whichever. I was born in this town, but I got to tell you, my friends, sometimes it's embarrassing to admit that I've been a registered Democrat ever since I first registered some 41 years ago. We have got a nanny state that is running amok. Now, before the smoking ordinance came to Eugene, and we created that great oxymoron, the non-smoking saloon, there were 375 non-smoking venues in this town. People had a choice. Since the smoking ordinance, smokers like me no longer have a choice. If you want to play a game of pool, socialize with friends inside out of the cold and the rain. No, back of the bus hill, they'll kick you straight off the bus because there ain't no smoking in there. You have turned smoking into the negritude of the 21st century. Smokers and gays are about the only people that you have left to discriminate against, and by God, you're doing it in one hell of a fashion. Now, it's said that the smoking ban is for the health and safety of the workers. It's for your own good, dears, and we know what's best for you. Well, golly, these are the same workers that have to leave the bar, go outside to smoke a cigarette, and watch the bar from there because that's the only place they can smoke. And I know a number of people, bartenders, in this situation. There are choices for non-smokers. It is getting more and more and more to the point where the smokers are being cut off left, right, and sideways. And as a smoker, I've got to say that, quite frankly, I'm getting pissed off. Yeah, I've had enough. Stop this. Now, as I said previously, smoking is the negritude of the 21st century. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'll say this once and I'll say it loud. I am not your nigger. And before you sick your dogs of war on me for smoking in a public place, I would remind you that the United States Supreme Court has decided that the burning of an American flag is constitutionally protected as free speech. Now, unless you're willing to posit that the burning of a cigarette in this forum, with this subject under discussion, is any the less protected as free speech. Yeah. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. Okay. Otherwise, I'd be delighted to see you in court. I think I've made my point.
Mr. Levin, and I would suggest you put your cigarette out since it's against the law.
As I said, I think I've made my point.
Okay. Next, we will have Julia Martin.
Welcome to the Republic.
Yeah. Let me know.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Sorry. Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Julia Martin. I'm a resident of Eugene, and I'm a long-term member of Tobacco Free Lane County. And I wish to speak in favor of Senate Bill 571, and in particular the provision that states that smoking is restricted within from 25 feet from doors, windows, and ventilation intakes of places of employment and public places. I can think of four common sense reasons why the 25-foot rule should remain in this bill. Firstly, non-smokers should not have to pass through a cloud of smoke in order to enter or exit a public place or work in order to go to work or even to testify at a Senate hearing. The 25-foot rule would basically help to prevent secondhand smoke from contaminating doorways. Secondly, smoke has a habit of drifting and can easily contaminate indoor air. Earlier, Don Austin spoke about a study that was done in indoor places of particulates. Well, I was a volunteer on that study. I went to several places in Eugene, all of which were complying with the law, but we found that there were raised levels of particulates close to the exits to smoking areas. So we knew that secondhand smoke was coming back into the building contaminating the indoor air. So 25 foot, I think, would go some way to prevent that smoke from drifting back indoors. Thirdly, and I think Mayor Kitty Piercy spoke to this, when the smoke-free law passed in Eugene, we had a lot of businesses do some creative things to try to create outdoor smoking areas. And usually what they would do would be put a roof or a wall around an existing patio adjacent to their business and then call that the smoking area. And we went and visited some of those areas as members of Tobacco Free Lane County and found them to be very, very smoky. In some cases, people who worked in those businesses had to go and serve patrons in those areas. They had to make sure that those patrons were, you know, supervising them and serving them in that area. I believe that if we had a 25-foot rule instead of the 10-foot rule that we currently have in Eugene, that would actually discourage businesses from constructing these types of partially enclosed smoking outdoor areas. It would just make it impractical because they'd have to build away from their building. Fourthly, including this type of restriction in a clean indoor air bill is a growing trend. In Washington State, as you've heard, they passed a law by a vote of the people that includes a 25-foot restriction. In Hawaii, where I was fortunate to just visit, they have a 20-foot provision. We know that in California, many communities are passing laws to increase the amount of feet from the door that smoking is allowed. And so I think that these communities have indicated that it really does make good sense and that this is the trend, and we should be following that trend too. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that I hope our experience in Eugene will serve as an example of why it's important to have a smoking restriction that's greater than 10 foot. So please keep the 25-foot rule in this bill to ensure that all Oregonians are adequately protected from secondhand smoke. Thank you, and I'll take any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Questions from the panel? Thank you very much. Wallace Siskowiak.
How are you doing?
Hi. You didn't bring any cigarettes, did you?
No, but I'm a smoker.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Wallace Siskowiak, and I have four vending machines in Springfield, Oregon. And I'd like to say, I invested $3,500 in each machine when our last governor, before this one we got now, would give us a clause where we could keep our machines and keep in Springfield and keep the bars going and smoking. Do you remember that? I'm just curious.
Not sure. Why don't you
tell me about that? It was my grandfather clause.
Mm-hmm.
Is what it was. Kitzenhopper, I believe. He brought that up. So I invest money. Those machines bring me a measly $500 a month. But it gives me something to do. I'm 73 years old now. I started smoking during the Korean War. There's not a thing wrong with me. I just had a chest x-ray 4 months ago because I had a cold. And they can't find nothing wrong with me. And where this secondhand smoke comes around, I don't know. I raised three children. None of them smoke, and there's nothing wrong with them. So it's kind of hard for me to believe about this secondhand smoke. And as far as the machines go, I never asked the state for anything. That my Social Security and $500 I get out of those machines per month, I take care of myself 100%. Don't want no Meals on Wheels, and I don't need any handouts from the state. I pay my own medical bills and so forth. And that's about it. And I think the old fellow with the long white hair, he was halfway right. It seems like the senior citizens are the ones, if you wait another 5 years before trying to pass all this, we'll be gone. And you'll have a lot easier time with it. But it's the senior citizens. We were brought up in the 50s. And there's a lot of us. A real lot. I go to with my friends to the bars. I don't drink alcohol, but I don't like it. I don't like perfume. It makes me sick. It really does, the smell of perfume. I can't help that either. But I don't tell a person to get away from me or something like that over that.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, we have two people signed up as U of O students. I want to make sure they get on. Amelie Rousseau and Ashley F. That's all I have here. We'll bring you up together. We have more proponents than opponents, so I'll probably be taking the proponents in groups of two. Welcome.
Hi. Okay. My name is Ashley Thrower, and I'm a representative of the Student Health Advisory Committee and Students for Smoke Free Campus. I'm here to represent students' rights for clean air. In our workplaces, we have demanded the removal of cancer-causing substances such as asbestos. Tobacco smoke should be no different. Student workers in restaurants and bars have the right to be free from carcinogens. 25 feet gives an adequate amount of room to reduce these carcinogens. In Eugene, our 10 feet permits secondhand smoke to occur. A statewide 25 feet will protect the public. And I would just like to speak against what the speakers up here who were against these measures told you. It seems that they told you very emotional stories. And I, as decision makers for citizens of all of Oregon, I really think you need to look at the numbers of people who are being affected by secondhand smoke and the people who will be affected by not being able to play games because it's health issues, public health issues. I have any questions? And I just like to state that I am a 21-year-old bar-going person, and I have personal experience with smoke in these areas, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions from the panel? Thank you very much. Amelie?
My name is Amelie Rousseau, and I'm here today to urge you to make all workplaces smoke-free. I'm in college now, but throughout elementary, middle school, high school, and health class, we learn about the dangers of secondhand smoke. And in restaurants and other places, I just don't want to be exposed to it. People who smoke or are exposed to smoke are sick more often, have to miss school or, you know, other activities. The other side is that my name is Amelie Rousseau, and I'm here today to urge you to make all workplaces smoke-free. I'm in college now, but throughout elementary, middle school, high school, and health class, we learn about the dangers of secondhand smoke. And in restaurants and other places, I just don't want to be exposed to it. People who smoke or are exposed to smoke are sick more often, have to miss school or, you know, other activities. The other side is that lots of restaurants apply young college-age students, and I personally wouldn't consider applying for one of those jobs where smoking was allowed just because my health isn't worth, you know, a paycheck. It's free, you know, it's smoke-free here in Eugene, but back in Portland where I live, if I wanted to get a summer job, it really limits the places where I would apply to. Restaurant owners don't want to lose smoking customers, but the fact is that there are four times as many people who don't smoke who would like to enjoy those types of restaurants or work there or, you know, what have you. So I'm asking you to vote yes on this measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Stephen Rowe. Mr. Rowe here? Okay.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Rowe. I live in Milwaukee, Oregon. My wife and I own two tobacco shops. Now we're down to one because we had to close one due to light rail construction in downtown Portland and decided to wait until we saw the outcome of the bills that you have before you. We decided we weren't investing money in a new business until we understood the rules of the game. My experience as the owner of a tobacco shop, and specifically when I look at measures 354 and 517, eliminate smoking in a tobacco shop. We sell a legal product. We sample the product. Our customers come into our shop to smoke the product because it's one of the last refuges left for a cigar and pipe smoker. That's primarily what our business is. It represents well over 70% of the business we generate in a given year. Through the sales of this product last year, my shop in downtown, which I just closed, generated well over $30,000 in tobacco taxes, which went to the state. My wife's shop generated at least an equal, if not much greater amount. In banning smoking in my shop, this bill will be an anti-business, anti-employee, have an anti-business, anti-employee effect. My customers come in and we have a lounge where our customers can smoke the cigars and smoke their pipes. They will no longer have that lounge because there will be no reason to go into the lounge. As a result, I have 7 full-time employees, 1 to 2 part-time employees. I will eliminate 3 or 4 of those full-time employees and all of the part-time employees. They will not be needed. So I guess they'll be protected, but they just won't have a job. I eliminated, lost 2 full-time people and a part-time person when I closed my downtown business because of the light rail, but the concern about smoking bans. So if this bill passes, it will have significant economic impacts on my business. It will have economic impacts for my employees, and I've heard anti-smoking people who just say, well, too bad. They'll find another job. Well, I hope they do, but right now that's the way it stands. With regards in general to bars and taverns, supporting the earlier statements, in my lounges we've had lottery machines. I've observed that probably 80% of the people who play lottery machines are cigarette smokers. That's all they do. They play lottery machines, they smoke their cigarettes, they leave. With a ban in the bars, as a general point of view, that lottery revenue will go down. If a cigarette smoker has to make a choice between playing lottery and having a cigarette, they're going to walk away from the machine. And this I've corroborated by talking to a number of other small lottery businesses, not the big guys that have got 6 machines and so on. These are the guys with 5 machines. In fact, I heard one guy say that's probably going to be the reason I drop out of the lottery.
Mr. Rowe, do you have lottery machines in your tobacco shop?
In my lounge. I have a smoking lounge. We serve beer and wine, and yes, we have lottery machines. It's an accessory used to our business. It's a small part of it, but it's the place for our customers to smoke, and then we added in lottery machines as part of it.
But your machines, wouldn't 100% of the people be smokers? I mean, don't they go there specifically to smoke?
They do. They do. Well, not 100%. It's definitely not 100% of the people, and we have non-smokers who do come in and play the machines because they're there, but they do come in because of being able to smoke. If they can't smoke, they're going to walk out. Some other comments. As a seller of tobacco, cigars, and pipes, the health risks, as demonstrated in studies, as corroborated by my own insurance company, show very minimal risk for a cigar smoker or a pipe smoker for either lung cancer or heart disease. A moderate 4 to 10% increase in risk for mouth cancers, but to be statistically significant, you have to exceed a twice level, not a 30%, not a 50%. You have to get up another 100% over. So for my customers, this is not a major effect. With regards to the science, I've heard some numbers earlier with regards to 800 deaths in the state due to secondhand smoke, 7,500 due to tobacco all over. There is no scientific basis for those numbers. They're pulled out of the air. There are not studies to support those types of numbers. If you look at the death certificates, there's a block that says, was tobacco related to this death? Yes, no, maybe, no. That's not a scientific study. There are so many mitigating factors in the world. With regards to other irritants in our society, my shop that I just closed was on the bus mall in downtown Portland. During the rush hour, we experienced 140 buses, TriMet buses, pulling up, stopping in front of our business. We, in our shops, put in air handling systems to keep the air clear, to move the smoke out, and so on. The dirtiest filter that we always changed was the one nearest the door, as smoke would come in from the buses. Clearly, in our society, there are cancer risks from buses, cars, if you drive here, secondhand smoke, primary smoke, but in the case of primary smokers and in my business, people make a choice to come in there. That product is legal. They want a place to enjoy it. Eliminating that protection for smoke shops just drives them outside, puts them into other people's face. And with that, I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Pazinski.
Mr. Rowe, I want to follow up on some of your questions, sure. Some of your statements, and ask you a couple of questions. It sounds to me your lounge is pretty much a service industry as to not only for the tobacco, but you also have other condiments for them to enjoy their
beer and wine.
All right. I don't want to go into specifics as to the amount of money you're getting, but can you break out the amount that you get from your selling of your product of tobacco versus what your beer and wine sales are?
Our tobacco products represent over 70%, 75% of our business. A portion of that is generated by customers knowing they can buy a cigar and go sit down and smoke it, whether they buy a beer and wine. Beer and wine sales represent less than 10% of our business. In other words, we don't depend on the lounge. The lounge exists because we allow cigar and pipe smoking in that venue.
Right. So if you had a choice of, let's say, maintaining a lounge for the use of tobacco only without having beer, wine, lottery, would that be something that you would consider in your own establishment?
It would probably reduce the amount of space that we allocate to it. People like to have something to drink, whether it's a soda, coffee, beer, glass of wine. We would also reduce the number of employees. There would be less reason to have three employees that work part-time or full-time in the lounge.
One other question, if I may.
Please follow up.
On your current scenario, would you define it similar to a bar in the sense of you, even though the primary product that's consumed there may be tobacco, you do in fact actually have all the condiments that if someone was going out to a bar where they could be smoking, drinking, and playing lottery?
It has the aspects of a bar, but it is an accessory used to our business. We've just gone through a four-year battle establishing that. It has been established by the state building officials that it is an accessory use to our business. That's why it exists. Without the ability to smoke in there, that lounge will close. We will have no reason for it.
But the flip to that would be if you didn't have the other accessories, that business could continue?
At some level, but it's going to be reduced because of, you know, people like to have something to drink when they're smoking, and it is a good place to meet.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a similar question to Senator Pozanski because I was reviewing the bill this morning and the staff made your summary, and I thought it was kind of odd that we would ban smoking in a smoke shop because that's what you are. You're purveyors of tobacco, and people go in there to try out cigars and things like that. So I thought that was a little odd, but your employees are still at risk. Are your employees smokers?
Yes. They came to work for us because we are a smoke shop. In almost all the cases, anybody who sells cigars is a cigar smoker. It is. You can learn how to sell cigars if you are not a cigar smoker. A number of them are cigarette smokers. In all cases, all of our employees smoke either cigars or cigarettes.
Madam Chair, as a follow-up, it's sort of like a purveyor of fine wine. You wouldn't be able to sell wine if you didn't drink it and taste it and know it. Right?
Correct. You learn the tastes and distinguish. It is just like wine because it is grown from the soil. You have different seed. The cigars have different strengths. They have different flavor profiles. Some can be very straightforward, common taste, start to finish. Others have high notes, peppers, spices. That's how you learn as an employee. There would be, they'd have to do it off the job, if you will.
My only experience with a cigar is it's a boy cigar, I think, when one of my children were born, but that didn't last very long. All right, thank you, sir. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
I'm off your cigar.
Well, I had a girl, but I didn't get a cigar the second time.
Okay, next we'll take... Susan Fanner and Rebecca Duffy.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Susan Banner, and I live at 1788 Riverview Street here in Eugene. Chair Jimmy Burdick and members of the committee, I support Senate Bill 571, SB 571, and particularly the portion restricting smoking within 25 feet of entries, openings to include air intake, exhaust ventilation, ports and windows in public and all workplaces. I'm a strong advocate of smoke-free workplaces. Oregon has an opportunity now to protect all people in their workspace. Environmental tobacco smoke, ETS, has immediate adverse effects on the cardiovascular system. It interferes with the normal function of heart, lung, blood, and vasculature. In humans, secondhand smoke has been shown to increase the risk of cardiac arrest and irreversible pulmonary damage. I would like to echo what Ms. Julia Martin said in her testimony. This 25-foot rule would provide more protection to bar and restaurant employees. I reiterate her comments regarding smoke entering lungs of people frequenting a public place, a business. The exchange of air taking place upon entering and or exiting a building ought to be the freshest possible, not tainted with smoke. My work in pulmonary rehabilitation centers on helping people with chronic lung disease. I help them to learn how to live with their impaired breathing. Most of these patients suffer from tobacco-related disease such as chronic bronchitis, fibrosis, and emphysema. They struggle day in and day out to achieve adequate breathing. I also work with people who are struggling with tobacco and are trying to quit. Over 75% of adult smokers would like to quit. For all Oregonians, smoke-free workplaces will improve quality of life by ensuring clean air to breathe, thereby enhancing the ability of those who suffer from tobacco abuse, less exposure, and those affected by lung damage to breathe more easily. I also would like to add that I agree with Wendy Bjornlund from OHSU regarding the increased or at least continued funding for tobacco prevention and education program as we roll out this new smoke-free workplace ordinance, hopefully. So in closing, I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity to submit this testimony and to be able to testify today. Again, I ask for your support of SB 571 to include provision to protect people from dangers of ETS a full 25 feet from buildings. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chairperson Burdick and members of the committee. I'm Rebecca Duffy. I live on Barbary Road in Dexter, Oregon. I'm married and I have two wonderful children. My testimony is not so much about the science, but a personal testimony. My children are 11 and 13. Before my marriage, I was a single mother trying to provide for my children. I was a general manager of a hotel, which included a restaurant and a bar. For 2 years, smoking was allowed anywhere in the building. I worked in a cloud every day. Everywhere I went, there was a smoker, and it has caught up with me. I was diagnosed with two different kinds of throat cancers. And excuse me for chewing gum while I'm testimony, but that's part of it. The first one I beat, but the second one metastasized throughout my body. The main tumor that has changed my life is the one that's wrapped around my brainstem and will not let go.
I am still trying to convince my doctors that I have never smoked a cigarette in my entire life. They said that it looked like I've been smoking for 15 years because of the type of cancer I had and because of the results that revealed my plaque-filled arteries. I have terminal cancer that can no longer be treated. I've been through chemo and radiation with my first one, which I beat. I'm living with cancer every day, and my family has to live with me. My doctors wanted to remove my voice box, which would give me a whole other 3 months. I chose not to do that because I want to speak on behalf of those who have lost their voice, the cancer caused by secondhand smoke. I chose not to smoke, but I couldn't choose not to work because of my babies. Secondhand smoke made me choose to live with cancer, and I want to help eliminate the chance of someone having to hear those words, "You have cancer." Please help me in support SB 571, because you could be saving your life or your family's life. I'm a daughter and a sister, a wife and a mother, and it isn't fair that something like secondhand smoke is trying to take that away. I support SB 571. Thank you. Any questions?
I mean, we really appreciate it. Jesse Day. Today is not here. We will have Allison Kunert. I think I murdered that name. And Kira with an Eastern European name beginning with S.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alice Kunert. I am a pre-med student at the University of Oregon. I am now a resident of Oregon. I've been here about 2 years. But today I'll be representing the Sclepes Club primarily, which is the pre-med society or club here on campus. And I'm also members of the Students for Smoke-Free Campus and SHAC, the Student Health Center Advisory Committee. Today I am going to speak in affirmation of the bill because Oregon is one of the best states, in my opinion, to live in. I moved here for reasons of, for primarily school, but Oregon is known for being a healthy state, and Eugene primarily, the no smoking and such was a big, big thing that helped, you know, in my decision of, you know, I want a healthier lifestyle, you know, it's a great place, Oregon's a beautiful place, and it definitely was a factor in why I came here. But as a member of all these committees for healthier living or just as a future health professional in our society, our main concern in most of these is health issues. I mean, we're living in a society where health is a very prevalent issue because it affects us not just now, but it also affects us in the future. And the effects of smoking, while many people don't see it now, maybe when I eventually get through med school or something, I'm going to be the one having to deal with it. Or, you know, it's something that there's a lot of contributing factors, as everyone has said, but regardless, it still is a factor. Just because there's other factors doesn't mean that it's all of a sudden not important. I mean, as students, we've seen the recent deaths of Christopher Reeve and his wife, and seeing that just by secondhand smoke, their family was suddenly destroyed was quite an impact for students around here. And as students, a lot of us, we have to work to get through school. You know, it's not easy. It's definitely not cheap. And many of us work, you know, at restaurants or bars, as was aforementioned. But what I did last year was worked at a CNA in a nursing home. So certified nursing assistant. And one of the saddest or craziest things was that with the 10-foot rule for smoking outside of buildings. We had people that they could smoke almost directly outside of the building, where these are residents that are way older in age, obviously very sick. They have reasons for being there, and their outdoor courtyard, where they're allowed to be to go outside, which was a rare commodity, was right next to where the smoking was for the employees. It did fall within legal restrictions and such, but it was still close enough, and it was, as was mentioned earlier, air circulates, you know, just a certain distance isn't always going to help, but just seeing that the employees that I worked with were smoking near windows where people live. This is their home, not much of a home, but it is still their home, and they're already sick, and just the effects was so detrimental just to see that it was within such reach. And even just as a basic employee to be submitted to their smoke and such was definitely not a good thing. As a student at the U of O, most of us, we're a new generation where we want to have a choice. And as many people have said, choice is a big thing. It's a high priority. But most of us here, and especially in Eugene, choose to not smoke. 80% of us, as mentioned before. And if 80% of us are choosing not to smoke, I mean, so be it for the other people who actually do smoke. But just walking around campus, walking around buildings, or just having to work to make ends meet, you know, why should we have to be subjected to that? People have the freedom of choice. You can still have the right to smoke, but I just urge that it doesn't infringe on our right to choose not to do it. People can choose to not drink, and they're not forced any effects of it. You know, why should it be different with tobacco? So, I mean, as a member of health committees and as a student, I just urge that these issues be taken into effect, because it's not necessarily your generation that's going to have to deal with the majority of these problems, but it's those of us who eventually, when we get out of school, will have to take into account the effects of what has happened in society. And as students, we'd love to have the choice or freedom to not be subjected to things that we have obviously proved to be very harmful. So thank you very much for your time. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kira Strelowitz, and I am a student at the University of Oregon. I'm a senior getting my degree in human physiology. I am also a peer health educator, so I'd like to represent them and the University of Oregon Health Center. I think I am in support of this bill, and from personal experience, fortunately, I haven't had to work, but my roommates have to support their way through school. And my best friend, she has applied or tried to get jobs at probably 8 different places, many smoke-free restaurants, but the only and nursing homes, but the only place that she was hired was at a bar. And she didn't have any other choice because it was either working at the bar or not getting a paycheck to pay rent in school. And I just think it's really unfortunate that she had to work, and she still does work in a bar where you walk in and it's just a big cloud of smoke. And she's 21, and I'm 21 also, and I won't go into a bar where they're smoking. I won't go into a restaurant where they're smoking. And I am a volunteer at a hospital, and I work in the emergency room, and right outside the door, not 5 feet from the entrance to the emergency room, people can smoke right outside. People are dying chronic obstructive to the emergency room. People can smoke right outside. People are dying chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and they're suffocating from smoking. And people are outside smoking, worried because, you know, their family members are inside dying from smoking-related causes, and it's really ironic to me. And there's really high levels, there's higher levels in secondhand smoke of cancer-causing toxins, and more than people are inhaling. And we have the right to breathe clean air. If they want to breathe in, you know, that smoke and do that to themselves, then, you know, that's okay. But they shouldn't increase my risk of a heart attack or stroke or sacrifice my health or anyone else's just because of their addictive behavior. Thank you.
Thank you. Davina Jones and Karen Oliver. looks like you lost them. They're from the Willamette Family, Inc., it says. For the record, these two witnesses, Davina Jones and Karen Oliver, signed up in favor of the bills. Our last, looks like our last person to be officially signed up, and we'll take anybody who hasn't been able to sign up, is Craig Lehman from Corvallis. Or maybe it's Lemon. Maybe it's Lehman. Okay, third time's a charm. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Craig Lehman. I live in Corvallis. I did bring some materials. I apologize for not having 20 copies. I was not aware of that.
Not to worry.
I practiced general surgery in Corvallis from 1957. And I view tobacco as a health hazard. I'm here to speak very much in favor of the Senate bill. I associate myself in particular with the courageous young lady who described her personal experience. That's really the thing that sort of thing that motivates me. I have many good memories and bad memories of surgery, but one of the bad memories is opening up a chest and seeing cancer inside, almost invariably in smokers.
The bills. Our last, it looks like our last person to be officially signed up, and we'll take anybody who hasn't been able to sign up, is Craig Lehman from Corvallis. Or maybe it's Lemon. Maybe it's Lehman. Okay, third time's a charm. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Craig Lehman. I live in Corvallis. I did bring some material. I apologize for not having 20 copies. I was not aware of that.
Not to worry.
I practiced general surgery in Corvallis from 1957. And I view tobacco as a health hazard. I'm here to speak very much in favor of the Senate bill. I associate myself in particular with the courageous young lady who described her personal experience. That's really the thing that sort of thing that motivates me. I have many good memories and bad memories of surgery, but one of the bad memories is opening up a chest and seeing cancer inside, almost invariably in smokers. I'm here to tell you that Corvallis's controversial ordinance that was passed about 10 years ago and then was upheld in a referendum to try to overturn it has been successful. There have been minimal complaints about the effects of this law, and Corvallis in general were very proud of this, and we're grateful that the legislature didn't repeal it when they passed the exemption law. They gave us, they grandfathered us to keep it in place. I've listened to the testimony of the opposition with mixed feelings. Barry Commoner, the environmentalist, said, "You can never do only one thing." And there's no question that it's going to disadvantage and have an impact on many people if these laws are passed. But on balance, I just don't see any real choice for me coming at it as a health professional. I was moved in particular by the testimony of the people who have calling on veterans. I'm going to go see another veteran, a member of my platoon at Iwo Jima. At Iwo Jima, there were 100,000 pack cartons of cigarettes that were landed on the island to supply us during the fighting. We all smoked, nearly all of us did, at night. There were little packs of four Marlboros, Fleetwoods, Chelsea's, and Marvels, offbeat brands that were in the K ration, C rations. If you grow up in the Depression, you don't want to throw anything away, and we smoked them up. When I went to medical school, I learned about the effects of smoking and cancer. I started trying to quit. It took me 30 years to quit, but I finally did. And I can truthfully say that my peers, my age, whom I knew in those times, who smoked, they've all either quit or died. I don't know anybody my age who still smokes what I knew was a child or in the service. Thank you for letting me speak, and I hope that something like 8B2571 passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. That concludes our signed up witnesses. Are there any other people here in the audience who would like to speak? Welcome.
For the record, my name is John Valley. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the American Heart Association, and I wasn't planning to testify. I was moved by several things that were said during the hearing, and I want to thank the committee for having this very important hearing. And there were some things said that I thought needed to be clarified for the record. I heard Mr. Perry talk about back in 2001, it was his bill that protected workers from secondhand smoke. It was the compromise bill that he put forward. That bill left 35,000 workers unprotected in this state. Some of the arguments that were made at the time, we need a level playing field. There were, at the time, lots of communities trying to pass smoke-free workplace ordinances to protect their workers. People like Rebecca Duffy. How powerful was that? It was just amazing. Those are the types of people that communities in the state wanted to protect. And the compromise bill decided that we were going to exclude 35,000 workers from, at the time, the state was saying, we know secondhand smoke is a dangerous substance. We as a state decided to protect 95% of our workers and excluded 5%. I don't think there's any doubt. I think the Department of Human Services will provide evidence that the numbers they shared today about the impact of tobacco use on the state is real, that the 800 people who die every year of secondhand smoke is real. Since 2001, if you do the math, since we had that compromise bill, there's 4,000 people who have died of secondhand smoke in this state. The time to act is now. The public is ahead of this, us as a state right now across the country. It was in the first panel, we heard about what happened in Washington recently. So our neighbors to the north have passed a comprehensive clean indoor air law. Our neighbors to the south have also passed a law. And even to our west in Hawaii, which I would say their economy is probably as reliant on the tourist industry, bars, restaurants, and other services that are now completely smoke-free. I would argue that the 800 people a year, the Rebecca Duffys of the world, that if there is a loss of revenue in lottery revenue, at least initially from this bill, I think we have to have a serious argument about whether it's worth a few more dollars for a few more lives. The bottom line, this is a public health, life and death issue. And I'm really proud of the fact that people have come here today to express their views. I think that's part of, you know, democracy and the marketplace. We hear a lot about the marketplace. Well, this committee, our state legislature, is the marketplace of ideas. And I think this idea's time has come. And I just wanted to state that for the record. I'd be happy to answer any questions that people of the committee might have and appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel? Senator Brzezinski.
John, do you know of the states that have these laws that you're talking about have any exceptions or exclusions?
I don't know them, Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski. I'm not sure of all of the exemptions or all the states. I think there might be a couple in each, and I think it's worth looking at. I think the important thing is that if we know secondhand smoke is a dangerous substance, do we allow it to be exposed to workers? I was very touched by the testimony by the bingo hall type people and the charitable work that they're doing, which I think all of us from the Tobacco Free Coalition, the Heart Association, Lung Associated Cancer Society, we're nonprofit organizations working to help people as well, and we are very impressed by that. I think the question is, if we know there's asbestos in a bingo hall, wouldn't we say we don't want to let patrons to attend that, workers to attend that, because it's going to hurt them. It's going to damage their health. There are health regulations all the time in restaurants and in bars that we are looking out for the public health. I think secondhand smoke should fall in that category. I think the U.S. Surgeon General's report last year that was described earlier, I think, makes the science very clear and very hard evidence. So there's possibility to look at exemptions, but I think the committee has to take in consideration, who are you going to choose to be exposed to secondhand smoke in a workplace? I think, you know, we make decisions all the time of what's toxic, clean air. I think we have shown fairly convincingly that secondhand smoke is a dangerous substance and we should protect all workers from it.
Want to follow up?
Please.
I'm specifically wondering more about the smoke shops. If there's some way to define
the basis as to what would be qualified, because my concern, of course, if you open up that type of a quote-unquote exemption, do you open up where bars become smoke shops, that type of thing? So I guess the question is, I'm wondering if you, since you've got, done the research, whether any other states have looked at that, and if so, how they've basically been able to identify and limit that exemption so it doesn't become the, let's say, the alternative for something that we would be trying to address through 571.
Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, I think you raise a really important question, and I don't have necessarily all of the exemption information at my fingertips. We can get that to you in writing. I think the point you raise is crucial, because I think there has been a pattern in the past of finding ways to get around the prohibitions. And I think the scenario you've articulated is one that could probably be looked at. And my guess is states probably have dealt with that issue, and we can provide those examples of how they've dealt with it for this committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our witnesses. Again, I want to thank everyone who participated in getting this meeting here. It's always wonderful to get out of the rarefied environment of Salem and get into actual communities to talk to us about some of these issues. It's been a good discussion. I want to specifically thank Dean Loya and Jill Forcier. And my, of course, my sister, Mary Wood, wherever she is, Professor Wood, who teaches law here. And thank you for your hospitality, and to let you know how much we've enjoyed this being here today.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Brzezinski.
Just to recognize Dean Loya. Loya is up here. Just to make sure everyone knows that he's actually here. And thank you again for letting us be here.
Yep, I looked at him, but I didn't gesture right, so thank you very much, Dean. Okay, with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.